You have said in some of your writings, some of your commentary, that the PCR test is fraudulent.
It cannot be used
in detecting COVID-19 during this pandemic.
It cannot be used to detect infectivity or active virus infection. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't me said that, it was the man who invented the PCR test and very many other eminent virologists and international scientists.
So you're speaking about
in the laboratories locally.
Hang on, one second. You're speaking about Carrie Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, who invented the PCR test.
Not alone. There have been professors and Nobel laureates in very many fields, and eminent physicians and surgeons and epidemiologists across the world.
And you're using this quotation from Carrie
Mullis. World Health Organization.
You're using this quotation from Carrie Mullis that the PCR test cannot defeat free infectious viruses at all. That's the quotation that's going around the internet.
Fauci have said the same thing.
I just put it to you.
Can I just finish this?
That quotation is not from Carrie Mullis. It's from John Lauritsen in a 1996 article about HIV. Carrie Mullis died in 2019. And the quote that is being used that's been attached to Carrie Mullis.
It is a quote that you've used. This is live science.
I understand what you're trying to say, but let me just get this
World
out.
World Health Organization
Let me just get this
said,
out. Hang on a wee minute. Let me just get this out so that people know what we're
I'm
talking
about. I'm not talking
about
Carrie Mullis.
Well, he's the man who won the Nobel Prize for inventing the PCR test.
He invented it, yes, and he said that about his test.
No, he didn't say that.
It was a research tool.
He didn't say that. He said that the test describes how you can detect the virus. They identify substances qualitatively, not quantitatively, detecting genetic sequences of viruses rather than the viruses themselves. He was not challenging the effectiveness of the test, and he wasn't addressing COVID at all. He was talking
about... This test does not test for a virus. It tests for a genetic...
So you're not a virologist.
No, but I can read virology.
What you have just been
telling
us about this test has been debunked by virologists. It has been fact-checked out of existence, and you are continuing to misinform the public with this.
The PCR test cannot test infectivity, which is the way that they are being used today. The lateral flow test may, and in fact is a much more effective tool, but that has not been used. The World Health Organization have said that multiplying these cycles more than 30, it gives no information, and many authorities would put it at less. And our labs locally are still using 40 to 45 cycles as of freedom of information.
So the PCR tests are used in the UK to detect the SARS-CoV-2 viral genetic material that is present in a patient. That's how it's used.
But these aren't patients, these are healthy populations.
That is how Carrie Mullis said it should be used.
There's a difference between a patient and a healthy population. Mass screening of healthy populations using a technology which has an unquantifiable false positive rate, and then applying that to entire population.
All of this is challengeable. We don't have time to challenge everything you say. But this is terribly important. It is terribly important that we don't misinform people.
You're absolutely
right.
Psychologically damage people, and as the pretext for lockdowns and mask wearing, and all of the other paraphernalia that goes along with the current medical tyranny that
we have.
It's
really important that we don't take a statement from John Lauritsen from a 1996 article in which he was denying the connection between HIV and AIDS because he's an AIDS denialist, and put it into the mouth of the man who won the Nobel Prize for developing the PCR test. It's really important that we get that right. Let me move on to another point that you make.
The World Health Organization are saying what I say.
They're not. Let me move on to another point you're making, which is masks. You say it at work. Why do you say that?
Because if you look at the size, we know that these are spread by aerosols, and the mesh size of most masks and the way that they're being worn mean that they're not effective. And there are at least three published papers now, and substantial papers, which show that they do not make any significant.
You've just been attempting to quote the World Health Organization as an authority in that last point. Do you accept what the World Health Organization says as an authority on this point, that masks do work?
They don't make a significant, and they are not going to make a difference in epidemic.
That is not what the World Health Organization says. Do you use them as an authority when it suits you and not when it doesn't?
No, I'm not aware of everything that the World Health Organization has said. I'm aware of the published research on the use of masks, particularly that recent paper from Denmark, which
constantly
shows that they
updated.
Have,
yes, constantly updated. And with every new bit of research, we get more confidence in the effectiveness of masks.
I would contend that the masks are there to keep us afraid.
You contend that the masks are there to keep us afraid?
Yeah,
is that a scientific view of yours?
No, that's an opinion.
Yeah, where does that opinion? It's not a scientific opinion. Where does that opinion
published
come from?
Research
Anne?
Which shows that masks statistically make no difference. And again, referring to our good friend Dr. Fauci, who said that that masks do not primarily stop the spread of an epidemic.
Are you broken by this politically and personally?
I don't know politically that I'm broken by this. Personally, I'm absolutely destroyed by this, and I will have to look at that and how I look after myself in some ways. But absolutely personally, I'm pretty destroyed.
I'm just looking at you. We're sitting here in the studio together. We've talked many times. You can be bullish. You're humorous, obviously. You're a big personality. You feel and look different to me just sitting there, actually. Are you okay?
Well, look, do you know, William, they're very kind words that you've just said to me there. And when you're going through this, kind words are in short supply, I suppose. So you end up in some ways isolating yourself, withdrawing slightly. And I feel that's what I have done. Is withdrawn and isolated myself from my friends, from my colleagues, because this is before I got into politics. This was 10 years ago. This is not the fault of anybody who's in the Ulster Unionist Party that I was not a member of. It's not a fault of any of my colleagues. It's not a fault of the party in general, but they're going to be linked to me and what I did 10 years ago, and I have to make sure that I stand alone on this one and take the blows alone on this.
Are you getting support from within the party, your party?
Yeah, look, I've got really good friends in the party. They're not just colleagues. I mean, they're genuinely good friends, and they are always supportive. We are always supportive of each other when we all go through difficult times. Mm. Genuine, we are, and they are being supportive. But it's still really important, and this is why I'm here alone today, and this is why I'm talking to you, is that I still have to take ownership of this. Mm-hmm. I have to look at what I did in the past. I have to confront my past, mm-hmm. because we can all have a past. It's how you go forward, which is the important thing. And for me, I have a vision, which is about people, which is about making Northern Ireland work for everybody who's here. And I'm trying to portray that. And now that's been undermined by things that I said 10 years ago. And they are just the worst things that I could have possibly said. And I can't apologise enough for any of that.
Doug, when you decided to move from a military career into politics, did anybody within your political world, within the Ulster Unionist Party, did anyone ever say to you, go and cleanse your social media, delete your Twitter profile, whatever, start again? Did anyone ever give you that advice?
No, I got into politics as a councillor in 2014, and the answer was no. It was pretty sharp. I joined the party, and 2 months later I was running in a council election, so everything was pretty sharp. Everything has been pretty sharp, if I'm really honest. And
did you know all of this stuff was sitting there, or have you forgotten?
Look,
the answer is
no. Somebody went and hunted and dragged it out, and send it to the media, but it doesn't matter what their reasons for that was. They did it because I said it, so the fault doesn't lie with them. The fault lies with me. So there's no point in me going back and saying what is the motivations for all of this suddenly coming out now. It makes no difference whatsoever, because the bottom line is at every single level, I said it, I wrote it, I tweeted it. It's my mistake, and it's me that has to own up to this and stand and face it. And I've said this time and time again. You can come out swinging and fighting back in regards to this, or you can come out and stand there and take the blows. And I have to stand and take the blows on this, because there is absolutely no excuse.
There are, I've lost count of the number of tweets we're talking about here. Some people say it's near the end. It's nearly 30. Mm. What have you got in terms of tweets we're talking about? Anybody counting them up?
No, I don't know.
People are counting them up. I mean, we're well over 20 here. They're misogynistic.
Yeah, they are.
They're racist. They're anti-traveller. You say you're not a racist. You say you're not a misogynist. You say you're not anti-traveller. But Maya Angelou once famously said, when people show you who they are, believe them. Why should voters believe this is not who you are?
Because I'm confronting it, William. Because I'm sitting here confronting it with you and anybody who I need to confront it with.
Were you a racist when you wrote those tweets?
Were you a misogynist? No, I wasn't. I wasn't a misogynist then. I wasn't a racist then. In many cases, at the time that it was, I was in a different environment. And you write things, in some cases you write them with a degree of dark humour. That's not an excuse. And please, I keep saying this, I'm not trying to make any excuses, but it was 10 years ago and I was in a different place, in a different environment.
The military environment. You told Stephen Nolan, you said that was a military environment, it was male-dominated, you used the phrase toxic testosterone, that kind of environment. Is that a justification for what you did?
No, it's not a justification for me. And I'm very clear, and I say this to everybody, that I am not trying to justify anything. But if people are asking me what's in my mind when I write things like this, and I'm saying, look, it's a dark piece of humour that we sometimes use as coping mechanisms. But that's not an excuse. I'm just saying that's what we...
Was he violent to the children?
Not myself. He wasn't physically violent to me. I have witnessed him being physically violent with one of my other sisters.
What form did that take? Can you tell us?
Well, the occasion that I had seen it happen, we were on holidays, and we were in the it was like a villa beside them. They were connected. And I had come walking up the path to go to my villa, and he had literally just thrown my sister across the room. And I walked in to their villa and took her out of it at that point. She was only a child.
How old was she?
In and around 11.
Right.
She wasn't old.
He was an abuser?
Yes, he was.
And a sexual abuser?
Yes.
Of children?
Yes.
Difficult territory, this, but walk us through your experiences and your sister's experiences of that, would you?
Well, again, I can't really speak too much for my sisters.
Sure.
Growing up, I believed it was only me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't believe that he would put his hands on any of his own daughters. My earliest complete memory was whenever I was around 8. I still find it very difficult to talk about the specifics, the details of it. And my sisters and I have never sat and discussed what has happened with each of us. But he would, he would tell me, he would threaten me with physical violence if I said anything. He had told me that if I told anybody, he broke down and cried and told me that he would go to jail if I told anybody, and that if he went to jail, then we would be on the streets, that my brother and I would end up in an orphanage and wouldn't see our mum again. And, I had that as an 8-year-old.
For a moment on what you've just said, you've said that, and this is your personal experience, that you received information from members of the security forces, which was essentially useful for targeting members of the IRA.
Indirectly.
And it was acted on.
Well, obviously it was acted on.
Does that mean that some people were killed?
Pardon?
Does that mean some people were killed?
Oh, quite obvious. You're giving information on people who were killing our and bombing our community into the ground. So obviously you can see it was acted on over the years because, no question that it happened, and it happened within the Republican movement as well.
So you are telling this story from your own personal experience?
Well, I'm telling you as it is, because I'm not going to sit here and tell you a load of lies and saying that there wasn't some type of support and help. Because, if we're going to heal the past and that, we need to come clean, and the Republican movement need to come clean too about their involvement with the Garda, the Irish, and the Irish government over the years. So if we're going to do this, we need to do it together. We need to be honest and open. And I'm using David Irvine's words when I say about the dirty war, because it's David that first described it as that. And that's exactly what it was. What we'd done to each other was despicable at times.
I mean, you're expressing quite a bit of candour here, that's for sure. Some people are responding and they're surprised, and some are shocked by the degree of candour that you're offering to us, because it is quite remarkable. When you say we all know this went on, Jim, and of course there have been lots of reports into it, we don't often hear a former leader within a paramilitary group like yourself from the Red Hand Commando background saying, yeah, it did, and I was there to see it going on.
Yeah, well, you know, do you want me to sit and tell lies to the people in the public and not try and let the people know how life was then, yeah, and how things were happening? You know, what's the sense of me coming onto your programme and tell you a bundle of lies and hiding? Because it's been said before by many loyalists that this is what happened. You know, I'm not the first loyalist to turn around and say that there was some type of help and support from the security forces, and explain why some of those security forces people may well have felt that they had to do that, watching their friends being slaughtered by republicanism.
And these were serving members of the security forces who handed over this information to you?
Well, as I told you, I got it third hand, so I'm not going to go into that.
So, but which means that they gave it to someone else who gave it to you?
The information came through my hands, and that's what I'm trying to tell you, and I know that it came from security force elements.
And was this in the form of documents?
It was in the form of photographs and names and addresses, montages.
Did it suggest someone's connection to the IRA or any other paramilitary group in the documentation?
No, it didn't have, like, the INLA, provos or anything like that on it. Stuff that came through my hands would have been basically names, addresses, on some occasions very few addresses, but mostly photographs.
Jim, was that essentially a kill list?
I wouldn't say that. You know, at the end of the day, the list is there and being given to loyalists who did say it and react upon it on for their information that they would attain themselves and find out who had been planting bombs in specific areas and doing whatever they were doing, as the Republicans were doing at the time, blowing up all over Northern Ireland, not just killing loyalists and unions, but killing their own people as well.
So are you saying that when you received this information, somebody would check the information that you were given before they would act on it?
Loyalists did not just go on a whim. And I mean, they had their own intelligence. They had their own intelligence officers. And for to listen to Republicans, you'd swear blind that loyalists, you know, couldn't go turn right or left on the road unless the security force. Absolutely not like that at all. You know, this is republicanism once again, trying to downgrade the stuff that went on. Loyalists had their own intelligence officers. They had their own forms of gathering information, and they were able to gather that. And on some occasions, I can tell you, some of that information came from Catholics and people within the nationalist areas because of the fact that they've seen what was going on. So it didn't just come from what the Republicans tried to make out security forces. It came through a lot of sources. And loyalists in themselves had their own intelligence networks that were good enough to detail and work out who were the main players within the Republican movement.
And I get that. I understand what you're saying. But you're also saying one of the ways in which you received information within the Red Hand Commando or other loyalist paramilitary groups was that you received directly or indirectly documentation, photographs, targeting information, addresses and the like from security force members.
Absolutely, but sure, that's been said before. That's been said dozens of times on programmes and television, and members of the UDA and the UVF and the Red Hand have all said that there was cooperation. And whether you want to take it to the extent of collusion going up the ladder, and that's for other people to work out and to find out. All I'm saying to you is that there was cooperation in some circumstances. At what levels, you know, I couldn't really tell you because we didn't go into all that. You know, you were happy enough to get the information in reference to Republicans who were bombing and murdering our people.
Was this collusion in your mind?
Well, you know, if you want to call it collusion, you know, you have to find out if it was a handful of serving police officer duty or soldiers that were involved in it. And, you know, I couldn't tell you that. All I can tell you was that most of the montages that we got were handed around other elements of loyalism, and to make sure that all within our sort of security networks that there was given these photographs and things. So it may well have been a handful of people. It may well have been more. I couldn't sort of express that.